Welcome to this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. Today we have Dr. Tim Elmore in the studio with us, and actually joining us today is Amber Strain. She's a new friend of Growing Leaders, and we're excited to have her on. So Tim, why don't you introduce Amber to us?
Amber, thank you for joining us here today. I've looked forward to this conversation with you for quite a while. We had you for lunch with our team, and you talked about the research you're doing and your background. So I want our listening audience now to get to know you as well. So why don't we start off? Why don't you tell our listeners what you do? And really a little bit about your background, how you got into researching what you do.
Sure. Okay. So I'm a PhD in cognitive psychology. I got my dissertation at the University of Memphis in 2014. And the research that I did there was mostly on education and helping learners be more equipped to regulate their cognition, so the way they think, their metacognition, the way they think about how they think, and their emotions as well. And the reason why I got involved in this is, you know, as a teenager, I always wanted to be a psychologist. And as I got a little bit older, I realized maybe that burden was just a little bit too much for me to carry. I didn't think I wanted the responsibility of counseling people. So I thought, well, what can I do that can make a difference without me personally having to give advice to people and all the burden that comes with that?
Sure.
I always had a heart for learning. I had a learning disorder as a kid. I still have it. And I just thought, you know, it would have been so wonderful if someone had really been able to come alongside me and not just help me through my coursework, but really teach me how to handle this problem that I have throughout my lifetime. So when I got to school and I started looking at PhD programs, what really stood out to me were programs that were focused on education and in particular helping students really overcome the emotional barriers and the cognitive barriers to learning. So that was what got me involved in educational research. And my goal was to be classroom focused. I wanted to learn how to help teachers be better teachers. But when I got into academia, I realized that there's this kind of trend right now for faculty to be creating these intelligent tutoring systems that cost multi-million dollars. And they take years and years and years of building and testing and research. And when they're finally done and they're all packaged, they go to the richest, most already equipped schools. And these students who already have all the resources have now an even better resource. And schools that are in lower SES neighborhoods, they can't afford these kind of technologies. And so we're putting these kids on a trajectory to just not compete with other kids that have these resources.
And by the way, those kids at lower SES situations might be just as gifted, just as intelligent, but you'd never know it because they don't have the advantages.
And in Memphis especially, this was a big deal. There was a huge gap in test scores. We have a thing called the TCAP. I think every state has an assessment like this. And we would see huge, huge disparities between kids who grew up just on one side of the tracks versus another. And we wanted to really figure out how do we equip students who didn't get a chance to go to the really privileged schools and put them on the exact same page as these kids.
So take just a real quick minute. You're getting to do now a little bit about what you studied for your PhD. Talk about what you do at Dakota and what you're most excited about perhaps at this point.
So my role at Dakota is basically what we want to do is we want to be able to ingest any kind of information from the web or from books or anything like that, anything that has digital content. And we want to be able to analyze it for emotions and cognitive states and metacognitive states. And now we're branching out even to life events. You know, we're recognizing when people are grieving or when they are considering a big life change. And what we're doing right now is primarily market research. So we're helping companies figure out how to better appeal to the emotions of their consumers. But that's kind of how we make the money. What we really have a heart for is figuring out, you know, how we help neighborhoods, how we help not-for-profits, how we help ministries and things like that to be more equipped and to better reach out to people within their neighborhood or within their organization. So one of the coolest things that I'm getting to do right now is I've just partnered up with a software company called Logos. And what they do is they have a huge warehouse of just all of the sort of faith-based texts and values-based textbooks and things like that. And what we're helping them do is identify people who need certain kinds of guidance or mentorship. So let's say that you have a teenager who's really, you know, going on Facebook or Twitter and they're talking about their parents going through a divorce.
Yeah.
Well, we want to be able to recognize that and help this company that I'm working with send content to them, books or videos or things like that, that will help this kid get through this tough time.
Yeah.
So that's one good. Of the exciting things that we're working
Absolutely.
On right now.
That's got to make you feel good when you can actually do good, do something redemptive with the technology that you've got. That's so neat.
Yeah.
Amber, you know enough about what we do at Growing Leaders. We've had you for lunch and so forth to know what we're about. We're about really developing a new generation of young leaders, healthy, emotionally healthy, well-adjusted people first and foremost, but then leaders who have identified their strengths and their gifts and they're serving them up to the world. Talk a little bit about, I know you agree with that end goal. You have been very encouraging to us, but what do you believe about students and graduates and what do you think they're going to need to really be adults that can self-regulate and manage their lives rather than just needing someone next to them all the time, even into their 20s?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. You know, that's what I love so much about Growing Leaders is that you guys want to equip students. You know, I feel that we sort of, in today's culture, we do a lot of hand-holding. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't, instead of teaching kids, this is a strategy that you can use whenever you're learning, whether you're alone or in a group. We say, all right, kids, everyone open up your books. I'm going to walk you through reading this section. Here are the notes that you should take. I remember when I was in school,
yeah.
I mean, they put the notes on the board and you just wrote verbatim.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Spoon feed, yeah.
Exactly. And you never learned. You never really learned. What is the relevant information from this? And what do I write down and what do I not write down?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that there are many, many things that students need to learn that we're failing them on right now. I think one of them is having a mastery approach instead of a performance approach.
Yeah, good. Talk about that for a minute. That's good.
Yeah, sure. So I think that our system right now cultivates this attitude of get the best grades, be the best one on the test, learn just what you need in order to get the good grade, and then be done with it.
Yeah.
And what it engenders in students is not a goal of learning for the sake of learning and being better. It's let me learn so that I either make sure that I look really smart or avoid looking stupid.
Yeah.
So in psychology, we call that a performance approach. But what we want to teach kids is a mastery approach. You know, instead of saying, let me make sure that I get the highest grade, they want to say to themselves, let me make sure that I understand this as best as I can.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah. And
in fact, if I can volley back, that's exactly what we're after. Wherever their gifts lie or whatever the subject is they're attempting to learn, to really come to a place where they're truly mastering it. And now it's not about a piece of paper with a letter grade on it or even a resume one day that I can just put another line on it of what I've done. It's more about I've truly picked this up and I'm a better person for it.
Exactly. And I think, too, you know, when you have this performance approach, what does it do to a student when they get a bad grade? You know, they immediately feel stupid. They feel like they didn't do a good job. With a mastery approach, what we talk about with students is, well, what does it mean that you gave it your best and you still got a C on that test?
Yeah.
What can you take away from this? What did you know that you really did well on? And what can you learn from getting this C that you can make sure that you don't do next time?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that makes everything be an encouraging experience, not a deflating one. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. In fact, Amber, what's running through my mind as I hear you talk is we're really saying we probably need to change the report card. The internal report card, that whatever the letter grade is, of course I want a good grade. That is some indication of if I pick this up here. But it really it's about I've learned this subject so well. There were definitely subjects in my K-12 education that I loved and did well in, but it didn't necessarily be – it wasn't reflected in an A. It was a B, but I loved it and I knew that and I've used it in my adult life. That sounds like really what you're after. Now, let me volley back one more thought that I think – might be right up the trail where you're going. One of the things we often say to moms and dads, as well as teachers, is don't think prescriptive, think descriptive. Meaning instead of just prescribing every, like you said, write down all the answers on the chalkboard, all you need to do is copy it down. We're prescribing every step along the way, which doesn't enable them later to do it themselves. Descriptive is to say, let's sit down together. Let's describe a goal that you want to reach together.
Yes.
And then you come up with the steps you need to figure out the steps you need to take to get there. That sounds like a little bit, at least a second cousin to what you're talking about, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Totally. I think we have a really, really big temptation to guide students, mm-hmm. You know, and we love them. We want them to
absolutely.
Do well. You know, yeah. We were talking about this earlier. It's like you love them. You don't want to see them fail. So let me really pull mm-hmm. you along. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, you know, some of my research is on boredom. And what you find is that these students who don't do well in class, a lot of times it's because they're bored.
Yeah.
And what happens is there are some bored children who act out, right? You know yeah. they're bored because yeah. they're flicking paper yeah. footballs yeah. and things like that.
Yeah.
But there's another type of student who's bored and who's just quiet.
Yeah.
They're not moving. They're really not imbibing anything. They're just sitting there being bored out of their
yeah.
mind. And those people, those students, they really just sort of go unnoticed, mm-hmm. right? And so you might not even notice that they're having a problem. And then you see they have bad grades, right?
Yeah,
so immediately
yeah.
what you do is you say, okay, let me help you do your homework.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that you're getting your homework assignments signed by your teacher
mm-hmm.
so we know you wrote all your assignments
mm-hmm.
down.
Yeah.
And rather than teaching the student, hey, here's what you should do when you feel bored in class.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a way to help you re-engage mm-hmm. when you're bored.
Yeah, love it.
We give them a task to do.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm bored because I was doing tasks that I don't enjoy. And now you give me more tasks that I don't enjoy. I'm checking out even further.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I think that's exactly what happens. And that's compounded by the fact that you often have, well, the speed at which our world is changing is changing rapidly. That's cliche. But so you got an adult that may not understand how rapidly the kid is getting bored. They feel like they got to do this dog and pony show up
yes.
front, you know, just to keep them, you know, entertained or whatever, or give them, like you said, another task. And that just compounds the problem. You know, can I share another thought that raced in my mind as I was listening to you talk? When we talk about lower SES situations and then these high-end upper middle class and upper class kids that tend to get all these, you know, the rich get richer. It seems to me like when a child is struggling, it usually boils down to one of two realities, abundance or abandonment.
Mm.
We've even done too much for them, given them too much, come alongside way too much, and now they're disabled because they've never had to do it themselves, or we've not been around. We've been emotionally absent. Sometimes the dad isn't around at the house, and so the young boy doesn't know how to be a man, a healthy
mm-hmm.
well. So it seems, and I know, again, this may just sound pithy and cliche, but it seems like those are the two dilemmas, and you're trying to shore up, let's get the ones that need us near them, and let's not do too much for the ones that already have been disabled because we've done so much.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I think about this, you know, I kind of can't help going back to some of my dissertation research,
mm-hmm.
and one thing that we found is these students that are using these intelligent tutoring systems, essentially all it's doing is it's taking some kind of imaginary scenario and portraying it to the kid. You know, they're on an island
yeah,
and
yeah.
they're having to solve, you know, someone's sick and they're having to yeah. figure out why this person's sick, and it's imaginative and it's engaging,
yeah.
right? Well, so we thought, well, that's just, they're just using their imagination. You've created this huge, you know, web-based environment that's immersive that they can play in, but kids know how to use their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need
mm-hmm.
a big,
yeah.
this big multi-million dollar thing to why don't you just tell them, hey, imagine that you're on an
yeah,
island
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and you're trying to solve a problem. And mm-hmm. that's what we did. And we found that these students, when they're given an imagination task, they are literally
yeah.
sitting down with a book or
mm-hmm.
with a computer screen
mm-hmm.
and they're reading a text.
Yeah.
And they can do the exact same kind of thing that these students who are being externally regulated.
Yeah.
But with these kids, we're actually teaching them something that they can do whether
mm-hmm.
they're in the workplace
yep.
or whether they're having
wherever
a boring conversation with an authority
yeah.
figure and they're having to listen
yeah.
and not, you know, imagine that, imagine anything, you know,
yeah.
and you can actually do this on your own.
Yeah.
And it works.
It's so powerful. I think the last time you and I were together, I mentioned Elena Bedrova. She's in Colorado. But she has developed a tool with a colleague of hers called Mind Tools. And she talks about the power of imagination. And she talked about experiments they were doing with preschool age kids. So we're talking about 3 or 4 years old. And she talked to a set of teachers that taught in this school. And she asked them how long they felt like these young children would be able to stand still. Or, yeah, stand still was one of them. And of course, they thought, oh my gosh, 5 seconds max, you know, that sort of thing. But when she began to engage her imagination and said something like, imagine you're a knight and standing in front of a castle and you're guarding it. And as soon as she painted the picture, they were able to stand still for minutes at a time. In fact, it blew the faculty away. But it was all about the imagination, which was already there. But somebody had to engage them at that level and not give up on them so
yeah.
quickly.
That's amazing. You know, I wish I had known about that when I wrote my dissertation because, I mean, we're dealing with college students and people are saying they probably don't have the discipline, in this case, to stand there that long.
Yeah.
You know, to see that you can do that with these little kids, it just shows you the power of equipping them and what they can do when you believe in them and you give them just a tiny little nudge.
Yeah. And then some belief. Yeah, you're right. So let's go deeper on this subject.
Okay.
I want to talk about self-regulation. This is a term that's thrown around a lot in education. Self-regulating, the ability to not need someone else to regulate my behavior or my thinking. I remember a statement I heard someone say, and I've used it since that time. Someone once said to me, discipline yourself so somebody else doesn't have to. Mm. I thought that made sense. Talk about teaching a student to self-regulate.
Sure. So, you know, when we talk about self-regulation in academia, it's more about, you know, how do you teach this kid to use cognitive strategies? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these are as simple as note-taking or summarizing what they read, asking themselves questions. And then we talk about metacognitive strategies as well. There are things like judgments of learning. So you stop and you ask yourself, after I read this paragraph, did I really understand this well? Right. So it's like a check-in almost.
Right.
Or we do feeling of knowing, right? So you read something and you think, I feel like I've heard this before. I wonder where I heard this. Mm-hmm. And the other self-regulation is emotional regulation, checking in and saying, I'm frustrated. What does that mean? How do I become unfrustrated? So what we've done in academia, unfortunately, is that we've built, once again, these tutoring systems that are supposed to teach self-regulation. But where I feel we're missing the mark, even though these tools, I do believe, have a lot of capability to teach students to self-regulate, we're not making the connection to them that, hey, you're learning self-regulation strategies to go use when you're not in front of this computer.
Yes, yes.
But what you hear students say, we interview them after they use this tool that teaches them to self-regulate, and they say, I just wish that I could have that tool on my computer so that it would help me to do this. And we're like, no, that's not the point. You're supposed to be learning to do this on your own. But so that's what where we're trying to go.
That's good. I love that.
Yeah. How do we get them to rely on themselves and not rely on the tools that taught them to self-regulate?
A year and a half or 2 years ago, I was thinking about these very subjects, and I did a blog post that surprised us in that so many people read it and passed it on. So we knew it must have hit a jugular vein. But I basically talked about mistakes we were making. And I mentioned these. I feel like we've risked too little. We've rescued too quickly. We've raved too easily. And we've rewarded too frequently. And of course, this was middle class America. But in doing all these things that were all well intentioned, we actually removed the ability for them to not need us raving all the time, to not need us giving a ribbon to them just for doing basic things. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And it's the ability to be me and the best version of me without the help of anybody else. That's the greatest gift I think we can give to them. Totally. When I think about myself as a dad, I think true good parenting is my son and daughter, Bethany and Jonathan, don't need me now in their 20s. Now, I want them to want me. I want them to be around, but it's not because they need me at 26 because they have no clue what they're doing. That's the gift I think you're talking about giving to students.
Totally. And let me tell you, you said that at the Growing Leaders event a couple weeks ago, and this totally blew my mind because you're absolutely right. And the problem is this problem starts in school and it carries over into careers. I can't tell you how many people I've hired in my organization who are maybe only 3 or 4 years younger than me who, you know, can't handle not getting immediate and
feedback,
feedback, positive feedback, who cannot show initiative, right? Who say each week, I want my list of tasks and I want to just do those tasks. And you have to think, they're being failed at a very early level.
Yeah.
Someone is not teaching them the value of showing initiative and the value of being happy and content with yourself and your work without people acknowledging it and raving it on it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I heard a speaker once say, she was an HR executive, and she said there are companies today that actually are hiring praise consultants, people to come in under the HR department so they can offer this positive feedback to the young professionals who desperately need it. And I'm thinking, I don't blame them. I blame whoever parented, led, taught, coached those kids.
Yes.
This addiction to tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm good.
Yeah.
It's just, it's sad, but it's our fault. It's not their fault. I think we need to correct it now.
I know this is your podcast, but can I ask you a question?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm curious about this. I hear this all the time. People talk about the ribbon effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
with kids today, everyone gets a ribbon, whether
yeah,
your
right.
team won
yeah,
or not.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's the MVP.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think this is really, really redemptive and really positive. Mm-hmm. We're teaching kids not to be performance
yeah.
focused.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it feels like there are some downsides. And as we talk about this issue of people needing mm-hmm. praise,
yeah.
It kind of draws my mind back to the ribbon effect. So mm-hmm. Can you tell me what your thoughts are about that?
Because yeah, I think you're spot on. There is a need for this. We need to teach collaboration, participation. That's how it all started. It started back in the 80s when we wanted to reward kids just for participating in the soccer team, just for participating in the art contest or whatever. What we weren't thinking about is the long-term effects of this, where at 22, they're not going to get a ribbon just for showing up at work on time.
Right.
You know? So I always tell adults, this works at 5 or 6 years old. It doesn't work at 10 or 11 years old. Mm-hmm. So I think it's totally fine to start in their young, early childhood years with affirmation of this. But eventually, a father or a mother or a teacher or a coach needs to sit down and say, Josh, Jessica, you know, from now on, it's going to be a little bit more like the world you're going to go into when you're 15 or 16 years old. And you want to tell you about that? Here's what it is. It's this and it's this, and you don't get it just for showing up. We owe it to them. So that's my thought. It works well at younger years, but I think somehow we kept doing it in the name of love or in the name of, well, they're our children and we want them with good self-esteems. What I don't think we figured out was that self-esteem is not developed by pure affirmation alone. It's affirmation and achievement. I need to feel good about what I've done.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying this is a performance trap. I'm just saying I need to use this God-given gift I have. And when I do, I love how I feel. In fact, let's take work for a minute. When I serve up my gifts to a customer and they like what I've done and they pay me, wow, there's something that happens inside of me that says, I want to do that again.
Yeah.
I think we're wired this way. And when we take it away, that muscle atrophies inside of us. It's just like a muscle that's inside of a cast that doesn't get used and it's just atrophied. So long answer to a short question, but okay, now back, I'm going to fire a question now back at you.
Okay.
You said something so intriguing to me just before we began this recording. And so I want to throw it back to you.
Okay.
You talked about the idea of control and how that was a detriment. What is it that teachers and parents really need to do? And it kind of revolves around this idea of control, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
So, you know, there's been a lot of research that has shown that there's external locus of control and internal locus of control. So external locus of control for a student would be, all right, guys, this is an hour-long time that we have for you to sit down and read chapters 7 through 8 in the textbook. I remember this happening all the time when I was in high school. And if you're an overachieving kid, you pick up on things quickly, you roll your eyes and you go, great, for an hour, I have to sit here. I'm going to be finished reading this in 20 minutes.
Yes,
and what
yes.
am I going to do with the rest of my time?
Yeah.
For people who have a harder time reading, there's anxiety that sets
yeah.
in. What if I can't finish this
That's right.
in an hour?
And then I look stupid because I don't understand it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what we tend to do as educators is we put these barriers in place by creating an external locus of control.
Yeah.
And I really think that you need that. You have to have parameters. What did I noticed in your Habitudes book, you quoted someone who said, talent without discipline is like an octopus with
roller skates.
Yes. You know, so I'm not saying that you can't have structure. You need it. But, you know, giving internal locus of control to a kid
yeah.
would be as simple as saying, hey, you know what, guys, we have an hour and
yeah.
we're going to read chapters 7 and 8. If you get done quickly, here are some discussion questions you could be
yeah.
thinking on as you read. For those of you who might not be
yeah.
finished in an hour, I encourage you to go home this evening and finish reading and then answer these questions.
Yes, good.
Just, you know, showing them that this is an hour of structured time, but you have the control
yes.
to go home and read more if you don't understand.
That's
you
right.
have the control to dig deeper if you read it quicker than other students. And you can see this just in all aspects of education and in
yeah.
the workplace as
yeah.
well. Just equipping them. You know, there have been countless studies where they have basically put students in the exact same learning scenario, but in one situation, the teacher would just say this one thing, you have to learn this and you have no choice. And in the other classroom, they would say, you're going to be tested on this, but you can choose to learn this or not learn it.
Yeah.
And you think this is very dangerous. You don't want to say this to these kids because how many of them are going to check out?
Yeah.
But they actually found that in the classroom, in both classrooms, they knew they were going to be tested. But in the classroom where the kids were told, hey, you can learn this or not, but just know you are going to be tested, they worked harder.
Isn't that interesting?
They spent more time studying and they did better on the test. So these students in the other classroom who were told, you have no choice, you have to learn this because there's a test coming, they felt defiant and they felt annoyed. And when they came across an impasse or an obstacle to learning, they got frustrated and they checked out.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is so profound. In fact, can I volley back real quick?
Yeah.
I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but in the very end of the book that I just released called 12 Huge Mistakes Parents Can Avoid, I have a list of shifts we need to make. And one of them is don't think impose, think expose.
Mm.
The impose is external locus of control. I'm imposing this. It's coming from the outside. Now they feel like victims of this horrible monster teacher, you know. But if we say expose, and by that I mean I'm going to expose you to an opportunity to learn this. You are going to be tested on it, but it's totally up to you. It's your call. All of a sudden now it's internal. It's up to them. So it's that shift from imposing, which we are so good as adults. We're always imposing. Moms are imposing in the house. Well, of course, they're the leader of the house. They need to. But at some point as a kid gets older, gets past 7 years old, and now they're 10 or 11, I'm leaving it up to you, son, to do this, this, and this. Now, what I love is if we go to expose, I'm going to expose you to some people that you may want to meet. It's your call. But boy, these are great people. Or this field trip or this experience that it's a really great experience. It's your call, though.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, now they're there because they want to be, not because they have to be.
Yes.
A world of difference in their attitude.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's funny, as you're talking, I'm thinking back to, again, something you said in the Young Professionals book.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about someone who used to work for you, who didn't want to have many of the rules that you had around here.
Yeah.
And they just said, you know, I have my way.
Yeah.
I like my way.
Mm-hmm.
My way works.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than telling this person, you have to conform.
Yeah.
This is what we all do.
Yeah.
You gave him the opportunity to do it his way.
Yeah.
And he did it. And, you know, what ended up happening is he said, okay, I get it. Your way is actually better. But it's cool that you gave up on that temptation to just force him.
To control.
Yes.
Yeah.
You said, all right, well, let's do an experiment.
Yeah.
Let's see how this goes if you do it your way. And I believe that if it had worked for him, that you would have said, okay, then, you know, we found something that works for you. So let's do it.
Absolutely.
But it just so happened in that case that, you know, those guide rails that you had in place were for a reason and they were good. And he eventually on his own came to the conclusion.
Well, I could tell this was you know, we all have a little rebel in us sometimes. So I could tell this was something he was only going to get on his own. Now, did I trust the process? Absolutely. And it was a little risky. But I also knew, as the grown-up in this case, that it wasn't going to be a world-ending thing if this little experiment didn't turn out right. And thankfully it did. And he bought in. It was great. But it was his call.
Exactly. Yeah. You gave him that internal locus of control.
Yeah.
And I bet every day after that, he came to work feeling like it's my choice to dress like this today.
Mm-hmm.
It is my choice to use this system that everyone else is using.
Yeah. And to avoid embarrassment because I realize what happens when I don't do it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I had that same thing happen. You know, I was showing up to work when I first finished graduate school, still dressed like a graduate student.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone was okay with this. No one ever called me out until one day a customer came in and I'm dressed like an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
I've got sweatpants on.
In a dorm.
My hair in a messy bun. And I was like, okay, it's time for a change.
Yeah, yeah. Now, see, that's so neat. And that was a bit of growing up for you, wasn't it? It was a little bit of growing up. Yeah. This has been so rich, but I want to give you a chance to volley out any more thoughts that you have before we wrap up, Amber. As you think about a teacher or a dean or a principal or a parent listening in, and this is your chance to just say, can I encourage you in this, whether it's based on research or just intuition or just what you observe anecdotally, what would be some words of advice you would give to people who are leading students and wanting to bring out the best, but somehow they've been control freaks instead of empowerers?
Sure. So I think that we've touched on a couple things that I would have said. You know, one of those is the control thing, giving up the temptation to control and to rely on your education. And these are the strategies I learned. I'm going to teach them now in this way. I would say the other thing is focusing on helping students understand the value of something.
Good.
you know, if you don't see any value in what you're doing, it's very hard to be invested in it,
yeah,
right? You know,
right.
For me, I have numeric dyslexia. Math was always a really big problem for me,
yeah.
You know, and I would sit there and I'd be like, oh, when on earth am I going to need to calculate the hypotenuse of a triangle?
Yeah, yeah.
This makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a teacher who just sat me down and said, Amber, this is hard. And I know you're going to struggle at this. And I know that you hate this and your grades are never going to be, you know, as good as everyone
yeah.
else's are. But you have to understand something. You want to go to college, right? Mm-hmm. You want to go get your
yeah.
PhD? Yeah. Okay. Well, Amber, you have to take this thing called the SATs.
Yeah.
And on the SATs, you yeah. have to know how to calculate
yeah.
the hypotenuse of a triangle. And you know what? You're going to have to do that again when you take your
yeah.
GRE.
Yeah.
And just something as simple as that, having a teacher
yeah.
do two things.
Yeah.
One, introduce the concept of value
mm-hmm.
to me, that
yeah.
even though you don't see an immediate yeah. value, there is
yeah.
value. And second, coming up alongside of me, this teacher,
yeah.
I never shared that I had numeric dyslexia.
Wow.
This teacher just knew that I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that I was in honors classes and every
mm-hmm.
other class, and
wow.
I was in remedial math, right? And he took the time
yeah.
to sit down with me privately and say, I care enough about you to give you this mentorship. You know, so I guess the first one is helping me see value
yeah,
and
yeah.
second, showing me that I had an advocate and
yeah.
someone who didn't just care about cranking out good grades so that
yeah.
he could get a pat on the back.
Yes.
You know, it was more Amber.
That's so good.
Yeah. Showing concern and care.
Well, now you're getting to the very root of what teachers need to be about. We never leave the foundation of I love these students and I care about them. We have a dear friend here in the Atlanta area that's overseeing a lot of teachers as leaders. And she always says, when I ask you why you teach, if you don't say something about I love kids, you need to get out of this business. And I think, you know, it's kind of funny that everybody giggles, but it's true.
It is true.
If I don't love the end user, they're going to know it.
Yeah.
They're going to figure it out and realize this is a job. I'm just doing time and it's about me and my paycheck rather than helping you really succeed. Okay, so I thought of one more thing before we sign off.
Okay.
I mentioned Dan Pink before. He was one of our podcast interviews a while back, maybe a year ago. He talked about an experiment that has been running through my mind all through our interview today with you. It was three groups of young children. I think they were 5 years old. And they were sat down in a classroom, and they were all told or asked to draw a picture. And he said, how many of you like to draw? Oh, they all love to draw. They're all artists, you know. So the first group was told, we want you to draw a picture, and when you're finished, we're going to give you a prize. We're going to give you a reward. The second group was asked to draw a picture. They weren't told about a reward, but they were given a reward. And the third group was neither told nor given a reward.
Okay.
At the end, they followed through. 2 weeks later, 14 days later, they sat the same group of kids down and said, okay, we want you to draw another picture, but this time no prizes. Nobody in the first group wanted to draw. Because it had moved to an external, if there's no prize, the satisfaction of simply drawing a picture was no longer there.
Mm.
Now, the last two groups still wanted to draw because they didn't know about a prize and one didn't even see a prize. I don't know what you're talking about. And I thought, what a great lesson for us as we lead and teach children. And I know these are 5-year-olds, but I think it works at 15. I think it works at 25. I think it works with grownups. If this is about building an internal locus of control, a motivation from the inside, where I love doing this. That's why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the paycheck, but I love doing this. and we do need to give them paychecks, but boy, now we get the best version of a person when we lead them that way.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, that's a great study.
It is. I know. I think about that very often with my own kids, with the staff here, with the students we lead. And in so many ways, I think that capsulizes what you've said today is if we're going to really help them become who they can become, it can't be about our control anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, Amber, we love having you on. We're going to have to do this again. Thank you for coming on the program and doing this interview. I so appreciate it. And glad you're in town. We're going to do it again.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
Well, thanks for listening in. What a wonderful podcast with Tim and Amber on how we can better lead the next generation, just how they're learning, how we can motivate them well. One of the resources that Tim mentioned in the podcast was his most recent book, 12 Huge Mistakes Parents Can't Avoid. If you're interested in picking up a copy, you can visit our website at growingleaders.com and order it there. And until next time, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast.